Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's edition of Brain Trust, Conversations in Psychopharmacology. I'm Dr. Joe Goldberg, Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. Pleasure to welcome you again to another session of our programs where we have conversations with leading figures in psychopharmacology and do some brain picking to try to really get at what's top of mind, most important, and how the field has been evolving and changing, so we feel very current and cutting edge in our knowledge of psychopharmacology. So today, my guest is a longtime friend and colleague. Those of us in the mood disorders research world think with enormous reverence about Dr. Bob Post, whom I want to welcome to the program today. Boy, we only have a short time, so if I was to read all of Bob's accomplishments, we'd be out of time. But let me just start by saying, Bob is professor of psychiatry at the George Washington University School of Medicine. He's founder of the Bipolar Collaborative Network, spent a good 35 some odd years at the NIMH, 20 of those as the chief of the biological psychiatry branch in a time and an era, I think, where so many of people of my generation really came to know what does it mean to push the boundaries of psychopharmacology in bipolar illness and recurrent mood disorders, and what do we think the underlying disease mechanisms are? I think of Bob as the person who really put anticonvulsants at the forefront of our mind and thinking about why would they work as anti-recurrence treatments in people with mood disorders. Bob talked about the notion of kindling and behavioral sensitization and rapid cycling and ultra rapid cycling. And for those who are not familiar with his work, you're in for a treat today because we're really going to be hearing from one of the leading experts. And I say that with without undue lightness in how we think about mood disorders. So with that intro, Bob, welcome to our show today.
Well, thanks very much, and thanks very much for that warm introduction. And yeah, I've got several messages. Several, I think, will be new, but the main thing is that in the United States, we have more childhood onset bipolar illness than in Europe. A quarter of it starts before age 13, if you'd imagine that. And the earlier it starts, the longer the delay to first treatment. And that's a double whammy because early onset is a poor prognosis factor for adult illness, and delay to first treatment is also an independent risk factor. So we have more illness. It's not well recognized and not well treated. And we now have K. Junior saying that overprescription is the leading threat to our nation's children, and he's got it absolutely backwards. Untreated illness is the greatest threat to our children. So we need to do it better and differently. And one of the things that's new or old actually is that we don't use lithium very much at all. Ross Baldessarini said that only 8% were treated with lithium with a new diagnosis of bipolar disorder, and more than 50% with antidepressants. This is really pathetic. And I think the reasons for this are we uniformly overemphasize lithium's side effects and actually call it toxic. And we underestimate its very positive effects. And we think it has all kinds of positive effects that are like a disease-modifying drug for rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis. The earlier you use it, the better it is, and that it avoids neurological and bone abnormalities and disease progression. So,
Neuroprotective, right? I mean, it was the original neuroprotectant in psychiatry, no?
and we've sort of gotten away from that. And I think we actually have to tell our patients to tell that tell physicians to tell their patients what the story really is on lithium, because it's changed. Everybody
You know, I
thinks.
can interrupt just for a second just to pick up. You've said so many important things already. I love the way you're framing the notion of the duration of untreated illness as having prognostic importance. As you and others have said, it's really no different in psychiatry than in infectious disease or oncology. The longer you wait to start the right treatment, the harder it becomes to treat the thing you're trying to treat. And lithium's always struck me as a really wonderful example of that. Going back to those old lithium studies that Alan Gellenberg and Alan Schatzberg did, showing that when lithium is really going to do its best, it's introduced within the first few episodes. And after many episodes have gone by, something that Robert Post might call kindling, it may not be as efficacious as if you gotten there sooner. Is that still true?
Yeah, that's really the case. And there's new data from Lars Kessing in Denmark that it's actually best to treat lithium after the first episode. And there's additional reasons to do that because they've looked at this in Vancouver. Lakshmi Latham is seeing that after a first mania, you lose some cognitive functioning and you get it all back as long as you don't have more episodes. So we need to stop episodes right from the beginning after the first episode. And that isn't often what people are told. And we need to tell people all about lithium's positive effects. It prevents mania depression, improves hippocampal volume and neurogenesis. It protects memory. It has anti-suicidal effects. And the thing I actually tell patients is that it increases the length of their telomeres. Some people like that better than it prevents episodes. And it decreases all-cause mortality, which is pretty amazing. And then there's a new one that just came out last week that it actually decreases bone fractures. So it does all kinds of good things. And we need to tell patients that story because they don't know it. And they think it's toxic.
Can
And
I ask you
they
a question on this? So you mentioned our colleague in Denmark, Lars Kessing. He published a study a few years back saying that lithium works really, really well in a fairly small number of people with bipolar disorder. And one speculation is that, like I was asking about before, if you wait too long to get it started, have you kind of lost a window of opportunity? I was curious if you agree with that proposition, and if so, is one of the reasons why lithium's fallen out of favor because it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You wait too long to introduce it, and so you don't really get as good a result as you might have if you hadn't waited too long to introduce it. And the remedy for that is to not wait, to find out at the first episode if someone's got a lithium responsive phenotype.
Yeah, I think you're right on it. A decade ago, I reviewed all the literature about the number of episodes in lithium response, and it's actually quite positive that the more episodes you have, the less well it works. So I think you're on to something about the self-fulfilling prophecy. So that's something that we need to think about. Get it in there better and
Could I
early.
ask you here then? So when you really made your innovative observations in the 1980s about carbamazepine and its relative breadth of spectrum compared to, say, lithium, I've always thought of your seminal work there as speaking to chronicity, recurrence, and episode number, and that people that have had many episodes may have experienced behavioral sensitization. And when lithium doesn't work in that setting, might at least some anticonvulsants work better because they're anti-kindling. Am I understanding your work correctly in that regard? Is that a fair statement to make?
Yeah, it is. The story with carbamazepine is interesting because it's the most potent in inhibiting after discharges from the amygdala. And we got caught up with the idea that the amygdala was key to this illness. And it turned out that not only carbamazepine, but other anticonvulsants like lamotrigine, and even valproate, for men now, we don't want to give it to women, are quite good. And I think what we need to think about is not only treating the illness well early and getting lithium in there early, but I think we need to treat with multiple drugs, particularly avoiding the atypicals that have a lot of weight gain and poor side effects profile. Use lorazepam, cariprazine, lumateperone, and actually lorazepam is very interesting because it's FDA approved for 10 to 17-year-old bipolar depressive, and in both children and adults, it works better in those who have evidence of inflammation by way of increases in C-reactive protein. So it picks off a tough to treat subgroup. So I think we need an atypical. I think we need some mood stabilizing anticonvulsants and lithium in there. And monotherapy is not where we want to go.
At least not unless the stars are aligned and your genetics are such that you are a lucky devil for whom lithium monotherapy works. And maybe that's part of the mythology, is that we have the fantasy that, one drug is gonna solve everything, but that's not the case in most of medicine, right? You've written things about polypharmacy and bipolar disorder long before the rest of us started writing about that, saying there's a complex phenotype that involves dysregulation of mood, sleep-wake cycle, and circadian rhythms, impulse control. There's so many domains. It'd be like having a bad flu and only using Tylenol and thinking that that's gonna, treat your cough and sputum production and fevers. So in some ways, a multimodal approach is more honest in terms of trying to target the various phenotypes or manifestations of the illness that we're after, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We have more comorbidities in bipolar disorder than in almost any other illness. And if you want to pick off anxiety and substance use, all these other comorbidities, you got to use more drugs aimed at these and other areas. So it's definitely not a one drug for.
Fair point to say, we talk about underdiagnosis, but there's really underdiagnoses. If, as you have shown in the Stanley Network, 3/4 of bipolar patients have a second psychiatric or substance use disorder. About half have two, about a quarter have three. So if you're dealing with a multi-diagnostic phenomenon, I think medical humility means to step back. It's not just like saying you have diabetes, but you have diabetes and nephropathy and neuropathy and retinopathy. And the longer the illness goes on, the harder it is to treat. But I guess the humility aspect is to recognize the many, many, many dimensions of psychopathology that come up in bipolar disorder.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the other thing is that there's more reasons now to think about lithium earlier than we even thought a month and a half ago. There's a new study in Nature that found that lithium in the brain is deficient in people with Alzheimer's and mild cognitive impairment. They made a model in animals that decreased lithium in the brain of these animals, and they got confused in all kinds of neurobiological abnormalities. And if they treated with lithium, the animals got better. But if they treated with lithium orotate, the animals got much better. And the reason is that lithium orotate doesn't get stuck in the plaques and tangles the way lithium does. So lithium orotate is something that needs to be investigated more for how well it's going to work, not only for bipolar illness, but for these dementias.
And we're talking lower doses in this domain than would be the case, say, in mania, right? Because lithium orotate can have the nephrotoxicity if you were trying to get somebody's, blood level up to like 1 milliequivalent per liter. So in dementia, we're talking about lower doses of lithium orotate.
Yeah, we don't know exactly what the dose is, but lithium orotate comes in 20 milligram pills, which is virtually nothing compared to our clinical doses, and it doesn't appear to have any side effects whatsoever. So it may be a real breakthrough drug. Regular lithium has some data in preventing mild cognitive impairment and even in Alzheimer's. And if lithium orotate turns out to be better, that would be a real game changer.
So can I ask you, as someone who cut their teeth pharmacologically learning about lithium back in the 80s, the idea of mood stabilization from any other type of molecule than lithium, I think was so brand new when you first published your work with carbamazepine. Can you tell us, what inspired your interest in carb, apart from the amygdala after discharges? Was there a sense that lithium doesn't work as well as it ought to? If it's not, then right. And so let's look at the notion of GABAergic and anti-glutamatergic drugs. I mean, it was such an innovative insight that you and your colleagues wrote about back then. What prompted that thinking?
Well, yeah, it was a number of things. The amygdala was one thing, but the other thing is that there were some data in seizure patients that they were less depressed on carbamazepine. That was also influential. And carbamazepine has multiple different mechanisms, including decreasing glutamate release. And it turns out that the profile of lithium and carbamazepine are kind of opposite. Lithium doesn't work so well in those with comorbid anxiety disorders. It works very well and where there's a family history of bipolar disorder, and carbamazepine, interestingly enough, works better in those without a family history of bipolar disorder. So it's picking off another group of patients. And along with your comment about needing more drugs to adequately treat patients, we found that the rapid cycling patients didn't do that well on either lithium or carbamazepine, but on the combination did much better than either one alone. And that's about the same story with lithium and most every other drug in our pharmacopoeia, that lithium helps those drugs work better. And I think we need to be thinking about lithium much more often than we are.
Even as a component within a regimen, if not as a monotherapy, it brings to the picture something that could be unique and maybe synergistic.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And almost the only people I know that get away with lithium monotherapy are in Canada.
And they're seen by Paul Groff and.
Yeah, those guys. And I don't even think that they have that much lithium monotherapy responders. The European lithium monotherapy responders often have multiple other drugs.
Well, maybe this does have to do with the early intervention or less of it in the US than you talked about at the very beginning. If lithium is more efficacious early on, and also if early intervention might stave off some of the comorbidities, back to the self-fulfilling prophecy. There was that neat work out of Pittsburgh showing substance use comorbidity lags behind onset of mood symptoms in bipolar youth. You're familiar with this. So that implies this window. You've got a couple of years. If I could successfully get leverage over a youngster's mood disorder, I don't think there's data for this, but it stands to reason to say, might I stave off the potential comorbidity of substance use disorder down the road if I successfully treated their mood disorder as soon as I see it?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely on target. The earlier the onset, the more substance use, the more other comorbidities there are. So if you get after the illness early and well, you may be actually changing the course of illness. And again, Lars Kessing has shown that in a randomized trial in people with early onset of mania. that he randomized them to clinical specialty treatment versus treatment in Denmark, which is pretty good anyway. The specialized treatment group did better not only for the 2 years that they were randomized, but for the next 6 years. So it really gets into the issue of if you treat well early, you're going to do much better by your patient and they're going to have fewer of these comorbidities. And the comorbidities actually each carry another burden, and that is you get more stressors, you get more substance abuse, you get more episodes, and each one of those three things changes our epigenetics. That leaves an epigenetic mark in the brain, and we're building up epigenetic marks on top of the genetic vulnerability. So things are going much worse if we don't get after the illness well. So my mantra is prevent episodes, protect the brain and body. And we need to do that much, much more aggressively than we're doing it now.
And this epigenetic notion that the environment can start to change gene expression and change the expressivity of the illness, I think is a point worth emphasizing. You were the one, I think, who first said, if you're lucky enough to have a good response to lithium and you stop it, you may not be so fortunate on a rechallenge down the road. And then you wrote a paper later on saying maybe that's because of a tolerance kind of phenomenon. But, when people debate this question of if you stop lithium, and then you relapse, can you restart it? Will it work as well? I wanted to ask you if one reason why it might not work as well is that the illness has changed. And lucky you had mania prone, few episode, non-comorbid bipolar illness. Yes, stop the lithium, and now you incurred all this additional psychopathology. And so by the time you come back and say, I wonder if penicillin's going to work again, now you've got on your hands vancomycin resistant staph. You've got a transformed form of the illness. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, exactly. I wrote an article about the dozen patients that I saw who didn't respond well to a new challenge with lithium after they stopped it. And now this past year, there are data that if you're on continuous lithium, that works much better than no lithium at all. And it works much better than intermittent lithium. So if you use the lithium intermittently, it doesn't work any better than nothing. There's a big study on that because it used to get debated that there was no such thing as lithium discontinuation refractoriness, which clearly there is in some patients. It's not everybody, but there is. And now the data support that in a large group of patients. So getting on the right drugs and keeping them on it and not having more episodes, as you're saying, I think is the name of the game.
So you brought out what you've called the non-homologous analogy to epilepsy when talking
Yeah.
about kindling, and that more begets more. And like epilepsy, bipolar disorder, and perhaps also highly recurrent unipolar depression becomes just harder to treat the more and more and more episodes you have. And this is where this notion of recurrence comes in. Could you say a bit more about your thoughts on you want to stop recurrences? It's not just treat this episode. It's you don't want your 14th episode. Is that a thing?
Yeah, it's yeah, you want to treat the episodes because of all the other bad things that happen with more episodes, including changes in the prefrontal cortex in the brain and all of those things. The other thing is you accumulate all these epigenetic marks from all the things that are going on. And now there's new data about the epigenetic marks, not only gets it transmitted to the next generation by way of behavior. But now there's new data that both in animals and humans that there's transgenerational transmission to the offspring, even in the absence of contact with the father. The data are amazing. Like if you give a father rat in this case, a shock and a smell. It turns out that his offspring who never see the father at all are more responsive to that smell and have more smell receptors in their brain for that specific smell. And there's lots of data like that in animals. Also, there's data that if you give a father rat THC, the offspring like opiates more than anything else. So we wonder how much of our opiate epidemic is because our parents did a lot of pot. The
Interesting.
other thing is that the data in people are incontrovertible also because the Dutch hunger stress has gone on for six generations, and you have more diabetes and obesity and all that kind of thing in people who had the Dutch hunger, and they've actually identified the epigenetic change that goes with it. So we're talking about changes in people's vulnerability based on their genetic vulnerability, but then with the accumulation of these epigenetic changes, that some of them are going into the next generation.
Now, we have lithium, we have some anticonvulsants, but not all of them as a class, right? I mean, not all anticonvulsants are interchangeable and have thymoleptic effects. They can be narrow in their spectrum. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Like
Tigabine.
gabapentin, topiramate are not good antimanic drugs, but they actually have a role in some of our comorbidities. So yeah, so some anticonvulsants have a broad spectrum in the illness. Something like lamotrigine is better in preventing depression than it is in mania, but some of the anticonvulsants just don't work in mania and yet may have a role.
Especially with the comorbidities, as you're pointing out.
Yes, yeah.
So I'm gonna do a deep cut in your catalog here. You and Tina Goldstein wrote an interesting paper some years ago about the idea that abrupt cessation of antidepressants could trigger mania, and you kind of implied that if a system is in homeostasis, ain't broke, don't fix, and you kind of pull the rug out from under the patient by quickly stopping, see, even an antidepressant, that might actually be a mood destabilizing event. And there's something about abrupt changes that could be, even with antidepressants, that could be destabilizing. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, you got it right. I don't know how potent that finding is. However, we never really demonstrated it in a large series of patients, but we did clearly see it in some patients. So yeah, I tend to like to stop things more slowly. However, if you stop lithium very, very, very slowly and the patient relapses, that does not protect you against lithium discontinuation refractoriness.
This idea of abrupt cessations is quite interesting. There's much interest in deep prescribing these days. There's a paper coming out from an Italian group this week, actually, in Lancet Psychiatry on abrupt versus gradual antidepressant cessation. And they found that gradual cessation with psychological support was actually protective against relapse in the coming year compared to abrupt cessation. So it's not just discontinuation effects and the short-term effects. It's if you actually land the plane slowly and gradually, you may prevent or forestall further pathology. It almost makes you think about just neuroprotective aspects that if you're going to do something, don't jostle the brain. Don't do it in an abrupt fashion.
Leave it to the endogenous mechanisms to slowly come in there and try to be therapeutic.
When you wrote about ultradian cycling, and a lot of people, I think, struggle clinically and phenomenologically, especially in younger patients, with mood instability as a kind of a symptom that doesn't necessarily track diagnostically. That is to say, you can have lability and affective instability in lots and lots of diagnoses, especially if there's trauma in the picture or substance use. Can I pick your brain a little more about what you wrote about as ultradian cycling and how you think about that relative to other kinds of just mood instability as a target of treatment?
Yeah, and this one's important for early recognition of the illness because Boris Brewer's group has looked at the kids who have the earliest onset, and they're the ones who have bipolar not otherwise specified, where they have ultradian cycling, multiple episodes or cycles within a day, and those folks are very difficult to treat. We looked at these ultradian cycling adults who definitely had bipolar illness, and we were surprised that almost 20% of them had some evidence of ultradian cycling. So people used to think that if you had ultradian cycling, you had borderline personality disorder, but that's not the case. You can have borderline personality disorder, you can have ultradian cycling, or you can have one or the other or both. So yeah, the rapid cycling patients are more difficult to treat. And one of the things that we found out is that if you treat these people with multiple cycles within a day, the ultradian cycling patients with the calcium channel blocker nimodipine, the dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, that's very effective for the ultradian cycling patients, including in some who didn't respond to lithium. And that's very interesting because one of the best genetic markers now is the people who have calcium influx gene that lets too much calcium run in. It's called CAC.
CACNA1C.
C. That's well replicated,
Tip of
and
your tongue.
it turns out that the dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, nimodipine, directly blocks that subunit. So there's evidence both that it works clinically in ultradian cycling and some mechanistically interesting data. I try to do a study to see if the people who had that gene were more likely to respond to nimodipine, but we couldn't get the company to give us the free nimodipine, so we never got this study done. But it'd be easy to do.
So the status of L-type calcium channel blockers in 2025, 2026, people have to go back a number of years to find your studies with nimodipine from NIMH. We're at the mercy of the pharmaceutical industry that there's just nothing proprietary of interest to them to go out and do a study tomorrow looking at ultradian cycling with whatever the most modern version of nimodipine might be.
Yeah, it's been overlooked, and I think it's ripe for a new look now with these with the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers in this gene. It would be an easy study to do to see whether the people who have that marker are better responders.
Interesting pharmacogenetics at play. Now, I'm going to take you back just for a second with the ultradian cycling. So, our colleague Ellen Liebenluft wrote about this concept of severe mood dysregulation. It was that paper that came out in the archives, I don't know, some years ago, saying 40-fold rise in pediatric bipolar diagnoses over the last 20, 25 years. Is that because we've really been missing it? Or is there this sort of intermediate phenotype of just mood instability that hasn't yet taken the form of discrete episodes, and maybe it'll grow up to be that. We need follow-up studies, but DSM-5 came up with SMD, severe mood dysregulation. Curious what your thoughts are about that, especially for the practitioner who's seeing a 15 or 16-year-old, and there's just a lot of mood lability going on, and whether SMD versus bipolar unspecified, how should they think about these dilemmas?
Yeah, well, the severe mood dysregulation is a problem because it has no specificity whatsoever. It goes with almost every other childhood onset illness, and there's no treatment that's been demonstrated that works for it. The other thing is the data that they cite that there's a 40-fold increase is not really a 40-fold increase in the diagnosis. It's a 40-fold increase in treatment and number of times people come in for treatment. So The idea that it's that much over the top, I think, is fallacious. And the idea from the Bermeer group is that if you have these ultradian cycling kids, watch out, because they are difficult to treat and it requires very careful treatment, and it's difficult to stabilize them. It takes 2 years to do that. And there's data from Barbara Geller and the Bermeer group that if you use lithium in kids, there's less depression and less suicidality. And that's lithium for kids with either the ultradian cycling or the classic kind of cycling. And if you take the kids who have ultradian cycling, 50% of them are going to turn out to be bipolar one or bipolar two if there's a positive family history. So you got to take this ultradian cycling very seriously and think about bipolar in these kids. And the way to do that is to think about things that are not ADHD related. Because if ADHD and bipolar in kids are highly comorbid, so you got to look for things that are indicative of bipolar and not ADHD, like insomnia, periods of euphoria, hypersexuality. If a kid has suicidality and homicidal thinking, delusions or hallucinations, none of those things are related to ADHD. They're all indicators of the comorbid bipolar disorder, and you got to go after that on its own. So the notion is you got to look actively for bipolar disorder in very young kids. We did a study with Findling that we could identify the kids who were going to become bipolar very early on, ages 3, 4, and 5. We had the parents rate the kids backwards every year of their life. And there are lots of the things that I just mentioned that actually distinguish the bipolar kids from the ADHD kids.
And when those identified kids, by definition, before age 12 with ADHD, who may have a loading or vulnerability for bipolar disorder, when they get stimulants, how concerned or worried should we be about polarity conversion or destabilization of mood? Or should we just say, well, keep an eagle eye watch on any kid getting a stimulant with a family history of bipolar disorder? Thorny issues around the iatrogenic concerns about treating one ailment.
Yeah, although the data are pretty clear that if you mood stabilize first, you can get away with the stimulants for residual ADHD almost all of the time.
Indeed,
So,
if you know they have bipolar disorder, but if they haven't declared themselves yet, or they may not declare themselves.
So what happens is, most of our kids are seen by pediatricians, and pediatricians know stimulants, and they know stimulants, and they know stimulants, and they don't know much about bipolar. So they give the kids tons of stimulants and antidepressants, and they don't work. So we need to change that formulation and get it back to a real diagnosis of bipolar when it's there.
So screening, family history. Can you say a word about, we always talk about it, but of course these are non-Mendelian complex traits. It's not like, having the BRCA gene in your parent and knowing something quantitative about your own risk. But how do you think about family history as informative? Certainly it's important, but how do you think about it?
I think it's crucial that if a parent has bipolar or even a grandparent bipolar, you got to be extra cautious about thinking about bipolar in the offspring. What we found was that the kids in the United States had these early onsets and more early onsets because of increased genetic vulnerability in the United States. And the other thing was increased psychosocial stress. We have more childhood adversity in the US than in Europe. And if you have both of those things together, The average age of onset in bipolar disorder is not age 26, which it was with not much of either one of those, but it's before age 13 if you have high genetic vulnerability and high psychosocial adversity. So the family history is quite important, and particularly if you add in the childhood adversity component, it's a vulnerability factor not only for early onset illness, but a more adverse course of illness. And then we looked at the kids who had only verbal abuse, no physical or sexual abuse, because we wanted to see if that kind of adversity also gave you an early onset and a poor course, and it does. So it's just the verbal abuse is sufficient to give you more early onset and a poor course of illness. So the idea of having these kids with early onsets in psychotherapy and family-focused therapy, Michelowitz's kind of therapy to cool off the intrafamily conflicts and
Expressed emotion.
the bad name calling, all that kind of, that's really important too. So having that component early on, I think, is also very important.
So some of these are lifestyle things, in terms of your sleep-wake cycle regulation and knowing how to manage negative communication styles and expressed emotion. Ellen Frank's work on social rhythm disruptions. It's almost like the way you would have to educate a diabetic patient, not just to take their insulin or their metformin or their GLP-1 drug, but they need to be cognizant of what the impact is of what they're putting in their body and what they're eating and how they're living and what their sedentary lifestyle, what their smoking habits or their drinking habits is doing. It really is as much lifestyle modulation as it is it's a pharmacological intervention.
Yeah, I think that's the key. In diabetes, you have six or seven different people, pharmacists, nurses, managers, all kinds of people trying to educate the kid on how to deal with the illness. And in our field, we have almost nobody. It's very hard to even get good cognitive behavior therapy or family-focused therapy in there. But that what you're saying is absolutely crucial. To having all of these other components looked after can make a huge difference.
So we're kind of getting near the end of time, but I'm going to ask you a really nasty question. I'd like you to look in your crystal ball. I'm sure you have it there on your desk somewhere. As you look to the future, there we go. As you look to the future, you entered this field at a time where we didn't have very much at all to treat this illness. So we didn't really even talk about bipolar one versus bipolar two or mixed and rapid cycling. And now we have so much heterogeneity in our descriptive prowess and different kinds of pharmacology options, not to mention device-based options. So I'm going to ask you to look in the crystal ball, Bob. Where do you see the future? If you were going to predict 10, 20 years from now, what do you imagine the pharmacological landscape is going to look like in bipolar disorder?
Well, hopefully we'll have better predictors of who's going to respond to what drug. In schizophrenia, they have every drug against every other drug and they know which one's better. We don't have anything like that in bipolar. It's generally ignored. But I also think that the brain stimulation work is going to have increasing presence. With the 10 hertz RTMS, repeated transcranial magnetic stimulation, you need 3 to 5 weeks. But with the new Stanford, not TMS, it's
Data burst,
Data Burst,
the same protocol.
T-Burst, you can get people very much better in 5 days. So using that more, and Vivetchelene showed that that works in bipolar patients too, not just unipolars. So I think we're going to have increasing amounts of brain stimulation. And the other thing I think we're going to have is while you're stimulating the brain, having active cognitive behavior and other therapies going on. So you have experience-dependent neuroplasticity potentiated by these stimulations and bringing out positive attributes of cognition with this combination of a brain stimulation and cognitive behavior therapy.
About NMDA receptor antagonism, the original studies with IV ketamine were done in bipolar depressed patients at Yale, and now everyone's looking at unipolar patients. But you think we're underexploiting NMDA receptor antagonism in bipolar disorder?
A little bit, but we're sort of creeping there. But like in everything else, ketamine's FDA approved for unipolar depression and not bipolar depression, even though it works as well or better in there. So yeah, I think we need to be thinking about that more often and other ways to potentiate the glutamate system, particularly the AMPA bursts. And that's also the case with psilocybin and some of the psychedelics that are working through the serotonin system. They also have a glutamatergic component. And they're very interesting because with ketamine, you need repeated treatment to keep it going. With the psychedelics, you can do one treatment, and sometimes you can have the response going for 3 to 6 months. So we need to get a hold of that mechanism that gives you the more permanent transformation of the brain synapses that the psychedelics have. And some people are working on psychedelics without the psychedelic component that do
Yes.
transform the brain. So hopefully we'll be going in that direction as well. So I think the future is promising as long as we don't listen to RFK Jr.
All right. Well, maybe that's a good place for us to wind up. Bob, you've taken us through, boy, de decades of knowledge. I don't know if people appreciate all the nuances and layers of what you've touched on today. You really were one of the first people, I think, to teach us about this disorder and how to think about what's going on with the brain and how to pair the right treatments to what we believe is the pathology in the brain that is the neurotoxic effects of recurrent episodes and the ways of improving neuroplasticity from lithium through certain anticonvulsants to newer agents. So I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I hope everybody found this helpful. And I want to thank our audience for joining us today. We hope to see you again very soon on the next episode of Brain Trust, Conversations in Psychopharmacology. For now, take
Thank
care.
you very much. Appreciate the invite.
Thank you, Bob. Take care, all.
This podcast is presented by Psychiatric Times, the number one psychiatric publication in the U.S. Visit us at psychiatrictimes.com for the latest clinical news, expert perspectives, and CME opportunities. Thank you for listening.